All right, thank you. I'm Bruce Lindquist, and today I'm going to talk about an agronomic assessment of greenhouse gases from our three major cereal crops. Before I get into that, though, I'd just like to acknowledge some of my co-authors, Kejan, Arlene, Cameron, and Chris. What I'm going to talk today about is greenhouse gas emissions. We're focusing today mostly on N2O. I'm going to deviate a little bit and include methane in that because I'm looking at these three crops, and one of the crops is rice, and methane is a big is emitted a lot from those systems. The other two crops are wheat and maize. These crops are grown globally on over a third of our cropland and comprise about 60% of our calories that we consume as humans. So the question, how this all started for me about 11 months ago, 10 months ago, I work primarily in rice systems, and I was talking with some rice growers, and a rice grower, Joe Carancho, asked me, why is rice always being picked on as having a big carbon footprint problem? And I didn't know if it was really being picked on or not. But I didn't have a very good answer for him. Rice is a very different crop. It's primarily grown under flooded conditions. So you have methane as a very important gas. It's also a less potent gas than nitrous oxide. And so I thought it was a very valid question. And I went back to the office and started to look around. I couldn't find any data. And that began the database that turned into this meta-analysis. But as we were going along, other issues, bigger issues that are concern, we wanted to address as well. And certainly if we look at agriculture, two major issues, not necessarily the only two, but certainly two, and these have already been elaborated on today, but ensuring global food security and protecting the environment. And are these two goals mutually exclusive? I certainly hope not. And I think there's been a lot of talk about sustainable intensification, which seeks to address these two goals. However, a lot of when we're looking at greenhouse gases, a lot of our metrics that we use to measure greenhouse gases are really looking on an area basis, and we can really miss the goal if we're not careful. So we need to look at another metric, and this is something that has been discussed today. This is just some work from Van Groningen et al. In a paper that they published last year. And if you look over here, if we just look at N rate versus emissions, we see that with increasing N rate, we get higher emissions. That's fairly straightforward. However, if we're trying to seek to reduce those, we'd be operating down in here to get those, and we'd be not certainly achieving the broader goal of maybe food security. And so they looked at a yield-scaled emissions of N2O in this study is the emissions divided by the yield, or in this case, N uptake. And certainly what we can see is this is related to N input, the amount of surplus nitrogen that was available. It could be negative, indicating that more was taken up than was applied. And you can be operating anywhere along this continuum and have similar yield-scaled emissions. However, if you're down here, again, we're not really meeting the goals of food security. We really want to be in this area right here operating in our systems. This presents really a win-win both for farmers and for the environment. So the objectives of our study was to really ask the question, is the GWP of emissions from rice, wheat, and maize systems, are they similar? And we're going to look at this on an area and yield scale basis. And under what conditions do we see the lowest yield scale GWP? And then just some implications that we might be able to draw from this on mitigation. So we conducted a meta-analysis, and this is just briefly some of the methodology we used. In searching, we did a fairly exhaustive search of the literature. We required that these all be field studies, that they all have seasonal emissions, not annual, but seasonal. We couldn't get enough for annual. For rice, we required that both N2O and methane be presented in those studies. For wheat and maize, we initially wanted to have methane, but only a few studies included methane, and so they only included, so we only looked primarily at nitrous oxide. I'll show you a little bit on the methane from that. And then yield. Interestingly, though, this yield really limited our data set, and the primary function of our systems are to produce food. It's amazing how many papers don't provide basic yield data, and that is limited our data set to what we have here, where we had 16 studies to 22 for, and we had a number of observations from 88 to 122. I'm not going to go through all the weighting and what we did. You can ask me later about that. So if we just look at our data, how representative was this data set relative to what we see, say, globally? This is the yields. And what we see is that in all cases, our study yields were higher than global averages. However, the relative differences between the crops remained. Maize is the highest yielding. Wheat was the lowest yielding. If we just look at seasonal emissions, this is in CO2 equivalents on the side here for the three different systems. The dark bars are methane, and then we have N2O. What we see is for nitrous oxide that maize had significantly higher N2O emissions than either wheat, and then rice had the lowest. If we look at methane, we see that they were both wheat and maize were slight, insignificant sinks for methane. But what really sticks out in rice systems is the very high amount of methane that is produced by these systems. If we sum this up, we're looking at about 4,000. Some of the nitrous oxide plus the rice or plus the methane, we're getting up around 4,000, which is about four times higher than we're seeing in either wheat or maize. If we look at this in relationship to nitrogen input across all of these studies, what we see is that methane, there's no relationship between methane and nitrogen input in rice systems, but we see a significant relationship between N input and nitrous oxide for all three crops. Again, a lot of scatter, but it is significant. What we see is that the emission factor for rice, though, that line is a flatter line, a lower emission factor in rice systems than in either wheat or rice. Again, we're looking at highly reduced conditions in rice systems, so a lot of that is emitted as N2 instead of nitrous oxide. Okay, we want to look at this on a yield scale basis for each of these crops, and the picture doesn't change a whole lot with respect to rice. Rice remains about four times higher. But what we do see is that when you look on average, the wheat and maize become similar, whereas maize emits more. It has a higher yield. And so the yield scale GWP across all those two systems are similar. But they still remain. They're about roughly about 200 kilograms of CO2 per ton. Versus about 650 for rice. So we wanted to look at this in different ways, and this gets back to that Van Groningen et al. Paper where they're looking at N surplus and managing. It's that surplus nitrogen that really leads to the elevated N2O. And we didn't have the data in this data set to look at that real strongly because we didn't have N uptake in all of these studies, but we looked at it a lot more simply. And what we saw in rice systems, we divided the data set into different N rates across all the different studies, from 0 to 50, 50 to 125, 125 to 200, and then greater than 200. In rice systems, there was no effective N input on the yield scale GWP. Again, methane is really what's driving those systems, and there wasn't an effect of that. However, in both wheat and maize, we did see not always a significant, in fact, normally not a significant But certainly the trend would be that supporting that Vagn-Grüttgen et al. Paper. We're at the very high end rates. You do see higher yield scale GWP. Again, supporting the fact that we, in these two systems, we really should be operating more in line with our optimal end rates, not the excessive end rates. Another way to look at the data that we pursued was looking at, for each of the individual studies, we looked at the lowest yield scale GWP for each of those studies. So our numbers of observations are decreasing here because this is just on a per study basis. But what we found was this was the yield under the lowest yield scale GWP, and this was the percent of maximum grain yield. So generally we were always above, the lowest yield scale GWP, it was always 90% or above that of maximum yield. So there wasn't a big yield hit. Those weren't significant yield decreases from the actual maximum yield. And interestingly, for rice, got a much greater reduction when you look at the lowest yield scale GWP. It becomes about double instead of quadruple that of the other crops. And from working from a rice perspective, this would suggest that there are a lot of opportunities to reduce the the emissions from those systems. And certainly there's a lot to work with in rice systems with water management, straw management, a lot of options that you don't have in your other crops. And so in some summary and conclusions, for our emissions, rice was much greater than maize, and wheat was by far the lowest. Our yield scale, GWP, the rice remained quite a bit higher than maize, which was equal to wheat. If we look at our lowest yield scale, global warming potential, it was near our maximum yields. This is certainly, I think, good news when we're trying to achieve those dual goals where we're trying to maximize or reach, ensure global food security as well as environmental protection. We need to, the strategies to reduce the global warming potential is certainly different between these crops. It's related to the soil biogeochemistry. Methane really needs to be the focus in rice systems. It's not, I know some people have looked at the soil as sinks in other upland systems, and that's very little opportunity in that area. And nitrogen management, and we've been discussing even here today, water management for your other crops. And finally, I don't want to suggest that anybody shouldn't enjoy rice for lunch today. There are a lot of other aspects to sustainability that we need to consider, just other than their greenhouse gas emissions. And some studies from China have shown that in rice systems, especially continuously cropped rice systems, there's a lot more carbon stored in those soils than there are in adjacent upland systems. So that's a factor that we haven't accounted for. We also have to consider how the crop is used. And just one example of this from a rice side is that 85% of rice is consumed directly by humans. If you look at corn, we're looking at less than 20% being directly consumed by humans. A lot of it goes to livestock feed or ethanol production, all which have their other footprints that we need to consider. And finally, ecosystem services. And all of our systems offer various kinds of ecosystem services. Working in the rice industry, rice fields are very important in other wildlife, particularly waterfowl during the winter. Where we flood the fields typically and get millions of birds coming down and using those fields. And with that, I'd like to thank you. We have been able to publish this recently. It's in press if you're interested in some more of the details. Thank you.
Hey, Ron.
Right.
I was just,
I
sent you by then there too. I thought it was
I was just in that with John. Yeah, we're looking only at... Oh, sorry. Rod was just indicating that there's a lot of nitrogen in the water that can move off field, either leaching or off the field. And that can be a considerable N2O emitted from rice systems that aren't accounted for here. So yes, if you account for those, the rice systems would even be higher. Well, we didn't account for that. There's very little data looking at that. So, yeah.
That may be the answer to my question, because unless I'm grossly mistaken here, they're getting into from denitrifying bacteria that are anaerobic. So in the rice system, we have low N2O, and in wheat and corn, neither of which is particularly drowned common, we have relatively high. There's that comparison again, but relatively high emissions. Is that curious to you, or is that explained by the water?
Well, actually, this study, the analysis here, if you look at the data, going a little bit and looking at some of the individual studies, a lot of the studies didn't take very frequent measurements of N2O. I actually think even in the field above ground, we're getting higher N2O emissions because we're missing some peaks. Generally, in rice systems, I believe most of the N2O emissions are actually coming off in nitrification, not denitrification. We're doing some studies in California where we generally see the N2O emissions during our drainage events, not when we're flooding the fields. And
so it's being trapped somewhere.
It could be being trapped, yes.
Well, what would the data look like if you measured the estuary of the Sacramento River? Wouldn't the wetlands be very high N2O emissions?
I don't know. I wouldn't want to. It could be, is
I'm
all I could say.
EPA's data on that.
You question whose?
EPA's data. 70% of emissions come from agriculture. I think it's vast happens. I think it's, what about natural? They're the natural system that denitrify.
Europe knows that a lot better than we do in the U.S.
Pardon?
Europe knows that a lot better than we do in the U.S. They study their natural system much more extensively.
What do they say?
They haven't really compared that with their agricultural system. They just understand their natural systems. We just have a dearth of information. Mm-hmm. We just have a great deal of information.
I think there's a gap here.
There is.
World nitrogen, this is the meaning, I don't know, the general discussion here, but it's clear that we've been putting nitrogen into the biosphere for 100 years, and it goes in every different flower. And one of the other things that we've been doing, for instance, in Florida, 80% of the mangrove mm-hmm. is drained. So that would be a massive reduction.
It would be,
in nitrogen
yes.
Put into the atmosphere. I don't think,
Well, it also gets to...
Let's make a quandary directly. Okay, we have two countervailing problems. If you listen to any of the main speeches, 2050 we have to have twice as much food as we have now. I don't think it's possible. If we go this way and limit nitrogen, it ain't going to happen. With current technology, it just ain't going to happen. So we have to get a whole lot more clever about how we do this. And one of the things may be perspective. What are the real global dynamics of nitrogen? And have we radically changed them by altering natural systems? And I think we have. And I think we've underassessed them.
I think that's a comment for more than me.
Yeah,
I think we're in the general session now.
Yeah,
so I'm going to step down.
Thank you, Bruce.
Let's give Bruce another hand. I thank all of our speakers this morning. I appreciate them for their preparation, and they've been so cooperative as I tried to organize this symposia, and I very much appreciate it. What a great session. Let's give them another round of applause. I also appreciate them keeping things on time. So we have a few minutes for general discussion, and I guess since I'm the symposium organizer, I get the first question to ask to you. To me, there's much that's said about this 1% number that's used, and as we try to assess and quantify, as Josh mentioned in his presentation, I think a lot of times we're qualitatively looking at, that was our goal. Our objective was to qualitatively look at polymer-coated urea compared to uncoated urea. Because I think it's a little bit disingenuous sometimes to say we're quantifying things. And how do we better assess? How confident are we in the in 1% number with IPCC shoots out, and I don't know. I sometimes suspect that it's higher than that, and that and you know, Bruce mentioned that, you know, maybe we're missing those peaks. I think our data would suggest that maybe we're missing some peaks, and that we don't always have a very good assessment. Any thoughts on doing a better job of quantifying nitrous oxide emissions? So Cliff's got to go. Any questions for our second speaker this morning for Cliff before he runs out the door? If not, we'll excuse you, Cliff. Thank you. Okay, other questions from our or points of discussion? Any follow-up to? Yes, Alan. You know, and I'll just follow up, and it kind of relates to my original question, is that I look at this, how we're doing these assessments, and there's so much is riding on these values that are coming out of the research, and yet I look at it and I think, boy, there's a lot of, you can shoot holes in the way we're doing business. You know, if we're taking, you know, we're taking GC measurements once a day even, that, you know, boy, we're really making a lot of assumptions on what happened during the rest of the day. And so I think this technology that we're using in our research is a great possible boom. Unfortunately, we have limitations with it too. I mean, the tubing length is important. And, you know, so we can do 24 different readings, but we have to put them all close together. And so we have to, you know, we have to vent them very carefully so don't cross contaminate. And so far I'm not totally excited about our ability to quantify how much nitrous oxide is lost. And it seems to me like we need to really look at methodology, and certainly something we're trying to do in our lab is look at, you know, truly quantifying, you know, taking frequent readings throughout the day and trying to get a better quantification. And, you know, and it's tough. It's really a tough thing to do, but that's where I want to go.